Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. Since 1916, Farm Credit Illinois has been helping farm families succeed, providing farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing. Farm Credit Illinois joins in celebrating the rich history of Illinois agriculture.
From the Good Food Festival and Conference in Chicago, I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This is the March 24 edition of the Closing Market Report. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's in Waco, Texas at Zwicker Consulting. Mike Tenora will join us at the end of our half hour to take up the weather forecast as usual from T-Storm. And along the way, we'll discuss good food, local food, and the kind of programming content USDA has been transitioning to those producers in this area. You'll be surprised by how much it sounds like a normal commodity conference. It all happens right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Here the way the numbers finished up in Chicago for this Thursday afternoon. Futures in the corn pit were higher at the end of the day, $3.70 the final trade for the May, up a penny and a half. July at 374.5, up one and a quarter. And December corn, a penny and a quarter higher at $3.87.25. Next year's March at 395.5, up 1 cent. Soy complex now, May beans up 5.25, finished $9.10.5. July at 917.75, up 5.5. November beans at 922.75, up 5.5. And January futures a settlement 5.5 cents higher at 926.5. Bean meal for the day at 275.30, up $4.40. The bean oil 18 cents lower at 33.18. Soft red winter wheat at 463 unchanged. July at 470.75, also unchanged for the day. The hard red at 471.75, down a half. July at 482.75 for the hard red. That's the harvest month, down a half cent. Live cattle futures in Chicago finished the nearby April at 135.97.5. They're 52.5 cents lower. June at 125.42.5, up 32.5 cents. Actually, both of those were up for the day. Feeder cattle March contracted 160.97.5, down 42.5 there, and April up 40 cents at $155.95. Lean hogs April contract $69.82.5, up 15 cents on the day. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Here's what some of the outside markets look like at this hour. Ethanol futures trading $1.42.8, up a penny and 9 cents. Crude oil at $39.38, 40 cents lower. Gasoline on the RBOB at $1.47, even. That's a penny and 6 tenths of a cent higher for the day. And heating oil or diesel fuel at $1.19.5, just about 8 tenths of a cent lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 17,359, 67 points lower. The U.S. dollar at 96.115, up 0.051. And gold futures on the afternoon at $1,221.20, down $2.80. The weather forecast for the Urbana-Champaign area says a 30% chance of showers this afternoon, mainly before 2. So they've already finished for the most part, a cloudy high of 62 degrees. And then we'll drop back for the rest of the day. Tonight, a slight chance of showers mixing with some rain after 7 in the evening, gradually ending cloudy, then becoming partly cloudy with a low of 30 degrees. It'll be blustery out there with a northwest wind at 16 to 20, and that'll decrease to 10 to 15 after midnight. Tomorrow, sunny skies, a high of 52 degrees, and Friday night, partly cloudy and a low of 35. Saturday, mostly sunny, a high near 60 degrees. Saturday evening, mostly cloudy and a low of 42. And on Sunday, showers are likely.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you today from Chicago at the Good Food Conference. It's at the University of Illinois Chicago Forum. We're joined by Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Dan, we're talking a bit early so that I can be on the road and get Commodity Week done this afternoon. So we don't have closes today, but soybeans are bumping up against some really important technicals. They have crossed over the 200-day moving average sometimes this week. Where do we stand, and what are your hopes for the afternoon yet?
Well, as we speak here with, a little more than an hour and a half or so yet to trade, May beans are in position to close above the 200-day moving average on a lead futures chart. That would be viewed as generally positive to the technical crowd, but what has happened prior to that, though, is the 50-day has moved above the 100-day. So I think that is one of the key driving technical forces of the market to push it on up toward this, or maybe even get that close above that 200-day moving average. And then the other thing, when you look at a weekly chart, continuous weekly chart, we did take out that December high of 909 or so, but we still have an October high on the lead futures basis that was made like on October 12th, and it's up there around 919 and three quarters, and so that's the key, I think, is the ask, get this close above the 200-day moving average right where we're at here, this 910, 911 area. And then if we could punch out that October high, then you would have to kind of view that we've got a breakout of a sideways trading market or a sideways basing. And then that begins to open up the door for some more loftier numbers. Don't know necessarily what the fundamentals will be to that kicks in to do that. We got two of them here as the South America crop may come in on the short side. It's not a done deal yet. And the trade has got some pretty big numbers priced into the market, so they may have to buy their way out of their short position if the South American crop is not as big as what they have got it priced in at. And then, of course, we get into our growing season, which is pretty much underway, but nobody's moving too much because it's just a little bit too cold, at least in the northern half of the growing region. I do know that they're putting nitrogen on in the southern half, and, of course, the far southern part of the Corn Belt. I'm sure that they've got some crop in the ground, but they've been pretty wet.
So soybeans are set up, but will corn and wheat come along with it, or do they just simply have completely different sets of fundamentals?
They have a little different set of fundamentals, but I do think corn is also in a nice position on the lead futures, where we're within a day or two. A lot of it's probably going to depend upon what next week's report is going to say as far as grain stocks and acres and whatnot. But lead corn futures is in position for the 50-day to move above the 100-day moving average also. And the 200-day moving average, the market did touch that here a week ago when it went on up into this 972 area. That 200-day moving average is around 372. And I think if we could get a good solid close in lead corn futures up above this 370 area, that all of a sudden I think would open up the doors that maybe this two-week sideways pattern that we've been trading in on lead corn futures, basically between 365 and 372, that could maybe be the halfway point of a move off of the low that we had in early March around 350, and that could maybe argue for a push on up into the 380s. maybe punch out the February highs here that were made here around the 373, 375. So corn futures look to be in at least technically, if the fundamentals don't turn too sour on us, that we could still make new highs for the year as we go through the rest of March and maybe on into the first part of the growing season on into April or so.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Just a reminder that the markets are closed tomorrow in observance of Good Friday, though it is not a national holiday, and the USDA reports will be released in the afternoon for the hogs and pigs. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason at the Good Food Conference and Festival that's taking place on the UIC, that's University of Illinois Chicago Forum campus here in downtown Chicago today. It's amazing to me how much this conference is very much like any other farmer-producer conference that I have been to. The topics have surrounded so far USDA programs like crop insurance and value-added markets and best management practices and things that farmers do in general. This morning, Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack was here, and tomorrow morning I'll have an opportunity to talk with him. We'll hear more about that next week. He made an announcement today that Sarah Eckhouse is here to discuss just a little bit. It's about a brand new tool that those who are producing local and organic foods and I suppose other things might be able to use. It's coming soon. It's an economic impact tool. What's the name of it and what's its purpose?
It's known as, and thank you, Todd, for having me, it's known as the Local Food Economic Impact Assessment Toolkit. And the point is to really understand what the economic impact of various investments in local food are and how they are contributing to economies and communities, creating jobs, and bolstering the economy. You know, if you want to know what the best thing to do is to make your community stronger and successful economically, you need to understand how these different investments are going to affect that, the jobs or the industry. And we see local food as a real driver of economic growth. That's why it's one of the Secretary's pillars for economic revitalization in rural communities. But being able to quantify those benefits is really valuable, and that's what the toolkit helps you do.
Sarah Eckhouse, of course, is the Chief of Staff for the Agricultural Marketing Service, or what we would normally on the air call the AMS. How will producers be able to use this, and will businesses be able to use it as well, and what kinds of things will it tell them?
In a lot of ways, I think it's actually more of a tool for businesses or investors or communities to use to make the case for these investments. It has a 7 modules that it walks you through in terms of the data that you need to collect and case studies, and it really kind of takes you step by step through the process to be able to create kind of an assessment of that impact that you want to have.
Sam Rickers is here as well. He's with Rural Development out of USDA in Washington, D.C. I want to continue to the discussion about financing to some extent, which is what we started with, an economic impact, but there are ways that rural development helps producers who want to enter this marketplace. Not only that, but businesses that want to enter this marketplace to find funding. What kinds of opportunities and funding might there be for them?
Todd, thank you. Great question. First, when I was a kid growing up in Wisconsin in the late 70s and 80s, what we saw were family farms, a lot of dairy farms, really shutting down, shutting their doors. And what we see with many of our programs across USDA, but the ones I get to work with directly, the value-added producer grant program, that's a program where it is an option and an opportunity for farmers, ranchers, producers to really develop new products, to use financing, grant financing, to get into new markets, and at the end of the day, increase their revenue. So if you're a commodity producer and you realize there's an opportunity to take your commodity and develop that into a higher value add product that's opening up a new market, getting you access into new places to sell your good or the new good you're creating, there's dollars available. It's a neat program where the USDA covers 50% of that grant. It has one part which covers the planning and feasibility parts, which are the initial phases of a producer or grower really developing his or her idea. And then once that's developed, the VAPG grant has a second portion which can help with grants up to $250,000 to implement that plan, working capital. So that's for the really the grower and producer to open that new market. But you talked about the businesses that are not necessarily the producers, but businesses that are involved in those local and regional food systems, whether processing food, serving as hubs for the food, and sometimes even in urban areas, there are financing tools that we can help with the Business and Industry Loan Guarantee Program. That financing can help with loan guarantees to really help not only companies in rural America, but also in urban America, provided they're connected with that regional and local food system.
Why is it that USDA is involved further down the marketing chain or the chain from the farm gate to the plate in putting assets, in this case financing, into businesses that are someplace in between those two?
Well, here's what we know. We know at USDA that while a huge part of the folks that we work for, and particularly at rural development, are the viability of Americans living in rural spaces, we know that strong connection between that urban and rural spaces and communities and businesses. So if we ignore the viability of the retail outlets where folks are consuming these goods, then we're not creating that pipeline for the growers that we support through other programs to have markets for their goods.
I want to come back to you for just a second, Sarah, and talk about another topic that came up on stage. Related more to the RMA, but AMS should be involved in the process, the crop insurance. Whole farm insurance is one item. Most of my regular listeners will understand what that really means, but there are insurance products for organic producers. It's tied or can be to the contract that they have. However, AMS is involved, I should think, in collecting pricing data on all kinds of foods other than the commodity crops that we're used to hearing about. Can you tell me more about the kinds of garden or truck crops that you collect information about?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really important thing that we've expanded in our market news service, which has been around for 100 years now, but it's continually adapting to market needs. So as we've seen the growth of organic agriculture, as we've seen growth in demand for local and regional foods, we're now doing market news reporting on hundreds of organic commodities, and we're also really expanding to report more on prices at farmers markets, in food hubs, farm to school, so that people who are selling to these markets, often at a premium, are able to understand what the value of their crops are. And so that's a really important thing. And I want to kind of second what Sam said about, you know, the middle of the supply chain. Local food at this point is an over $12 billion business. And it's expected to increase to $20 billion by 2019. So there's a real demand there, and to get that food from many of the rural communities to the urban areas that have such a high demand for it, we need those middle of the supply chain aggregators, processors, distributors, and there are real economic job creating opportunities there. AMS also has the local food promotion program, which was created through the 2014 Farm Bill, which offers grants of up to $500,000 and also smaller planning grants that are helping with that mid-supply chain process, helping businesses or communities develop those resources, whether it's a food hub or a distribution network that are servicing and creating those urban-rural connections that are connecting people to the land that they have, that having that connection which they haven't had for such a long time.
For more than 8 years now, the U.S. government has been involved in
developing these types of supply chains. I'm wondering why that is the case, and maybe each of you can think about that just a little bit. I understand, of course, and commodity producers might understand that at this point they're looking at abysmal opportunities for them in commodity markets for corn and soybeans and wheat in particular. However, these sorts of programs have been put in place for much longer than that, and certainly were in place to begin with as commodity prices were very high and they were doing very well. So a response that it's because the markets need a different place for farmers to go, I'm not sure is the one I'm looking for. I'm looking for a deeper response about why the U.S. government has decided to be building out a supply chain for local foods. And maybe you can also define local foods, because I think it's much broader than organic.
Absolutely. Local food and organic are certainly not the same thing. The Farm Bill defines local foods as either within the state or within a 400-mile radius. We generally aren't prescriptive in how we limit local food, but you know, I think one of the things that the Secretary talked about today is the diversity of American agriculture, and that is one of the strengths, one of the things that makes our agricultural system so strong. We have organic, we have conventional, we have GE, we have local, we have huge exports. Agriculture is really a bright spot in many parts of the economy, and we want to embrace all of that. In terms of the local and regional, we have seen that it is creating, bringing people back to the farm. You know, we also talked about the need for more new farmers to get involved. The average age of the farmer continues to rise. It's a lot of new, younger farmers are attracted to the local food scene or organic agriculture. And so it's creating these new opportunities, and we want to help advance that. And it's also something, again, that Congress has directed us to do with these new programs that they've funded, and we are seeing real positive results from.
Sarah Eckhouse, of course, is Chief of Staff at the Agricultural Marketing Service, and Sam Rickers is with USDA Rural Development. Your thoughts?
Following what Sarah said, the 2014 Farm Bill really had the USDA put that emphasis in so many of our programs on those new and beginning farmers. It also had us put priority on veteran farmers. So the face of the American farmer is really changing, and we're trying to really push back against the aging face of the farmer. And so we've seen a lot of excitement. It's that excitement that we see here today at today's conference. And so your question was really thinking about how and why the USDA might be pushing the development of this value chain and this business model. In my opinion, Todd, I think we're really following energy and markets that are being pushed by the market. What we're seeing is a demand for these products. We're seeing energy that we saw here today by growers and farmers and ranchers that we are helping facilitate, but certainly this is a market-driven demand.
Thank you so much to Sarah and to Sam. I appreciate them being with us here on the Closing Market Report. We're coming to you today from the Good Foods Festival and Conference at the UIC Forum in Chicago.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
It's National Chocolate-Covered Raisins Day. Historians say somewhere around 1000 BC, the first vineyards for raisins were established in Persia. Trade routes brought raisins to Greece and Rome, where they were eaten in large quantities. But it was not until the 11th century that raisins made a splash in Europe, when knights, returning from the Crusades, brought raisins home with them. By the way, it takes 4 tons of grapes to make 1 ton of raisins. On this day in agricultural history in 1765, the British Parliament passed the Quartering Act, which required American colonists to provide temporary quarters, food, alcohol, fire, candles, vinegar, salt, bedding, and utensils to British troops stationed in their towns in times of peace. The act was circumvented in all colonies other than Pennsylvania. In 1802, a patent was issued for the first full-sized road locomotive. It traveled in South Wales over 9 miles at a speed of 5 miles per hour, and it could pull a 10-ton load, 5 wagons and 70 men. In 1896, Clement Hardy received a patent for the rotary disc plow. His patent described a rotary disc plow constructed with one or more plowing discs arranged diagonally to the line of draft and supported by furrow and land side wheels and a suitable metal or wooden frame. In 1989, on this date, the worst oil spill in U.S. history occurred as the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Alaska's Prime William Sound and eventually leaked 11 million gallons of crude oil. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media this Thursday afternoon. It is the 24th day of March. I'm Todd Gleason, coming to you today from the Good Food Festival and Conference in Chicago. It's located on the University of Illinois Chicago campus at the Forum here. We're joined now by Mike Tenora. He's from T-Storm Weather, also out of Chicago, and he's going to discuss what's been happening in the growing regions around the nation. Mike, let's start with out west in the plains and what conditions the hard red winter wheat is working under.
Well, the interesting thing that's taking place in the hard red winter wheat belt is that it's turned fairly dry since about early January. This is a little bit atypical of an El Nino spring because almost all of them have been wet in the months of March, April when you combine them together. So March here is coming to a close. We've seen very little in the way of rainfall. And if you look at rainfall over the last 30 days, you can see that the hard red winter wheat belt is actually the driest of the last 5 growing seasons as far as the coverage goes. We're seeing around 80% of U.S. hard red winter wheat production having been drier than normal over that period. So that just tells us in a nutshell that we need some rain. We had this big system move through there yesterday, but it primarily brought rain and snow to Colorado and Nebraska. And that was along the northern fringe of the wheat belt, not really in those key areas of Kansas and on to the south. So as we go forward, we're going to need to see some rain. Now, there is a chance for rain there this weekend. We do have a weak upper-level system that will move right across the driest area. And sometimes that can lead to significant totals. However, there's a number of uncertainties with this system. And this is a very key thing to watch because if this rain event fails to materialize, we're fairly confident that there will not be very much rain next week. Now, all of a sudden, we're in April and we're looking for rain. Now, if we get big rains in April, that'll probably alleviate much of this dryness that we're seeing now. But if that doesn't happen, we'll have a serious situation out there. So we'll be watching that closely over the next couple of weeks. Again, there is a shot for some rain this weekend. We think the amounts will be on the light side, between 2/10 and 4/10 of an inch. With maybe a little bit of a rain later next week. Again, a very light situation, and then we'll just have to watch what happens in April.
The Corn Belt is a bit stormy at this point, but farmers are not too concerned about that. They'd like to know more about the beginning of April and what kind of conditions they might have for the very beginning of their corn planting season.
Well, it's looking a little bit stormy. We've seen this big storm move through yesterday and today. There is another system that moves through this weekend, a lighter one, not a really big one. But another big system does come through between Wednesday and Friday of next week. So that would be between March 30th and April 1st. Now, once that system goes through, it temporarily turns much colder. But we'll see a cooler pattern once we get into the first few days of April. And more than likely, we'll continue to see these systems roll on through. So it's hard to say what the entire planting season will look like. But at the very least, the beginning of it will have adequate to surplus soil moisture conditions with a break in this rainy pattern eventually becoming needed. Whether or not that happens is a little bit tricky to say. Again, we only can look out into about the first 5 days of April with any confidence, and it does look fairly stormy through that period. Keep in mind that a lot of the times when we start with an El Nino in the beginning of the year, and then we end up in a neutral or La Nina state by the summer, which is what we're expecting this year. We have wet springs a lot of the time, and that's what we're starting to see now, it looks like.
That's Mike Tenura. He's with T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason at the Good Foods Conference, also in Chicago.